Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Enterprise BUS 100 Section 8 for Spring Semester 2011. Lecture 2, delivered on February 17, 2011. The title of this lecture is Contracts. Today, contract. This is by no means a comprehensive lecture on contract law. It is an introduction to important concepts in contract as those concepts apply to business people. And you will be business people. You are already involved in contracts every day of your lives, I would venture to say. And this lecture gives you some terminology, clarifies some concepts and some constructs in contract. And it will be used as a platform for the lecture on Tuesday, which is on the agency dilemma. Let me start with a question for you. What is necessary for a contract to come into existence?
Agree.
It's good.
Both sides are agree.
Okay. That's the typical answer, is an agreement. In fact, it's actually a disagreement. Actual or potential? Why would you need a contract if there is no possibility in any way, shape, or form of a disagreement? The contract is a codification of the resolution of real or potential disagreements about the terms of the of what is under contract, about the considerations involved, about locations, clarifying so that there are no disagreements. Or if there are disagreements, we make sure that in the contract we have comprehensively covered any possible disagreements that could interfere with the execution of the agreement. Now, once we get to a contract is a special kind of agreement. We have many agreements to which we come in our lives, and many of them will not rise to the level of contract because of one or more defects in the agreement that prohibit, that prevent it from being, from qualifying as a contract. Now, occasionally, an agreement that is not a contract will rise to a level of what we call quasi-contract, where it has met many of the important criteria for being a contract, but hasn't quite hit all of the marks. And there is a body of law that recognizes quasi-contract. In fact, one of my favorite case examples, where the court ruled that a contract did not exist, and therefore the lawsuit under contract was thrown out. But the judge hinted in his opinion that the plaintiff might want to consider revisiting the case, but arguing under quasi-contract rather than under contract. So we have the possibility that even if it is not a contract, it might still qualify for recognition of protections under the law. But I would not encourage you to rely upon a hope of recognition of quasi-contract. If you want a contract, you make sure that what you have is a contract by virtue of meeting four pillars. Now, in some textbooks and in some lecturers' way, that might be three pillars. I've heard a law professor who gave six pillars. Hell, I even heard one who gave 10. I stick with four. A classic four pillars that make an agreement a contract. The first of those pillars is offer and acceptance. Offer and acceptance. There must be a bona fide, B-O-N-A-F-I-D-E, bona fide offer. It must be serious. It must be specific. And it must be in a timely construct. It must be serious. It must be specific. And it must have some timeliness to it. It can't be an offer for the rest of your life. That's the timeliness thing. It must be specific. It must give the details of that which is to be rendered under contract. It must be serious. It cannot be flip, just a joke. I would caution you, though, about that. You might think that it is a joke when you make an offer. A court might see it a different way. Okay, so you be careful when you say, well, I wasn't serious. I'll even give you an example of that if I have time. But the offer must be serious. Acceptance must mirror the offer. That's the mirror image rule. The acceptance must mirror the offer. That is the mirror image rule. On the quiz, I'm going to ask you a question that you must research and find out the answer yourself. Who controls an offer? Does the offeror or does the offeree? Now, it is not in Europe the same as it is in the United States. You will find that the control of the offer is different in different countries. But in the United States, who controls the offer? The offeror or the offeree? You will be asked that on the quiz. Now let me get back to the mirror image. I put my car up on Craigslist for $1,000. And you come to me and you say, well, I should like to buy that car. Your terms are fine, but I'd like to pay $800. Now, has he accepted my offer? Has he accepted my offer? Why not? Say it.
He didn't take what you offered
him. It was not the mirror image of my offer. Good. He actually made a counter offer. He made a counter offer. A counter offer kills an offer. A counter offer kills an offer. My offer with respect to you is dead. My offer is off the table. So I say, I reject. So you call me back a week later. You know what? I'll take that $1,000 offer. And I say, no, that offer does not exist anymore with you. You killed that offer. You're now making me an offer for $1,000 for the vehicle. I'm not offering you $1,000. I can't. No, well, I'm not, because you killed my offer with your counteroffer. So if you want to pay me $1,000, you are now making an offer to me, a new offer. Okay? Because he killed the offer when he made the counteroffer. Minor deviations, you got to be careful, because minor deviations might get through. But really, in a case like this, $1,800, no, he killed my offer. It's gone forever. It's dead. It's with Jesus now. It's out of the question. And now I must decide whether to accept or reject his offer. Now let me go to another portion of this idea of offer and acceptance. It works like this. Suppose that I am running an auction. And I'm the auctioneer. And when I was a child, I actually watched my father. He was one of those old-time auctioneers. He gave that cadence. It was so cool. I never did learn how to do that. But I would watch those auctions, and you can watch some of these maybe on some of these specialty channels. You see an auction at Sotheby's. We have a painting here that was done by artist Joe Smith. Now, this painting, we are going to start the bidding at $1,000. Do I hear $1,000? Okay, now, did the auctioneer just offer the painting for $1,000 or not? Did he or not? He, in fact, did not. He solicited an offer. He did not make an offer. He solicited an offer for $1,000. And someone holds up a card. That is the offer of $1,000. $1,000 has been bid on this painting. Do I hear $1,200? $1,200. And that is a solicitation for a counteroffer. So you hold up your card and that means $1,250. Your counteroffer has just killed the offer. So now you stand as the offer at $1,250. And then we go through, we get up, let's say, to $2,000. And $2,000, do I have $2,500? No one's raising a card. $2,000, going once, going twice, sold. When the gavel comes down, that is the acceptance. That is the acceptance. The gavel coming down, the offer of $2,000 has been accepted. Okay. It's an interesting thing when you begin to realize what constitutes an offer and what does not. Okay, now let us, later in this lecture, I will talk about oral versus written contracts. But before I even get to that, let me point out to you that an oral contract is every bit as good as a written contract. There's no defect ipso facto in an oral contract. In fact, most of the contracts in which you will engage in your life will be oral contracts. You will be in oral contracts executed day in and day out throughout your life. And almost always they will execute perfectly. I go into the, who looks like a McDonald's cashier? You do. Yeah. I walk up and I look at the menu board and you're standing there. May I McHelp you? McPlease? Why, McYes. I come up. And I say, okay, I should like a... I'm hungry. Let me get three double cheeseburgers and a biggie fries and a quart of Coke. Okay, now, and you say, that will be $8 and $0.20. Now, who was the offeror and who was the offeree in that? Was this man, as the agent of McDonald's, the offeror, or was I the offeror? Why was I the offeror? It was their store. Well, they had it up on the menu board. Well, you know what? The menu board is not specific enough to be an offer. They didn't tell me how many and exactly what I wanted to eat. They did not make the offer because it can't be an offer because it wasn't specific enough for an offer. When I gave three double cheeseburgers, a giant fries, and the quart of Coke, that's specific. God, am I hungry? Why did I do that? You know what? I'm going to go out and find a cow to eat after this class. Okay, you understand? That menu board isn't specific enough. Now, this takes us into a larger realm. In general, an advertisement is not an offer. An advertisement is not an offer. It is a solicitation for an offer. Ads do not open a contract. They are merely a solicitation, a suggestion that you come in and make an offer. The reason the advertisements in general are not offers is because they are not specific enough in terms of when, how much, and all of those things. That's why you have to be careful when you make an offer, when you do an ad. And I'll tell you a story here in just a second about that, but let me be clear here. Because your ad is not an offer, under common law, it is not recognized as an offer generally. That means that you have more latitude in an advertisement to say things, to write things, to represent. That is because you're not actually the opus of the contract. However, famous story, if I understand the story after all the iterations it's gone through, this was long, long ago. There was one of those fancy women's clothing stores that opened up in New York City. The first 100 customers at the door at the grand opening will get a fur coat. And so we'll get one fur coat each. And it was very much like that. The first 100 customers at the grand opening, which starts at 8 o'clock in the morning, will get one fur coat each. Well, there in the line, one of the first people at the door was a guy. And they took one look at him. No, this is for ladies. Get out of here. And they threw him out. He sued. He said that was an offer. And the company, of course, said absolutely not. Advertisements aren't offers. The court ruled in this man's favor because the ad had gotten too specific. The time, the location, the number of the items, the number of people who would get them, that was specific enough to be an offer. And so they said, give him his coat, pay his lawyer bill. Okay? So you got to be careful. When you are advertising, don't get specific. Because you could very well step across the line and be making an offer. And then suddenly someone says, I accept. And you say, no, wait a minute, I didn't exactly mean, you know. You be careful about that. Let me take a quick deviation here. I sneaked in a term, common law. Law can be divided into all kinds of, divided this way, that way, on different dimensions. One of the ways that we can divide law is into statutory law versus common law. Now, statutory law is written law. Many societies their law is based in statutory law, written law. Every rule is written down, every law is in the books, and any adjudication just goes right to the books. The other kind of, and many of the countries of Europe, you will find that they are statutory law countries. And the reason is that they were under the rule of the Romans. And the Romans were the ultimate in statutory law. And as a matter of fact, I would argue, as some other scholars would argue, that one of the reasons the Roman Empire began to come apart was because with the statutory laws building, 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 it just got to be ridiculous. No one could follow all of the written laws. There ought to be a law. Okay, we'll write a law. You're a special interest group. We're going to cater to you. We'll write a law for you. Oh, that's a terrible situation. Well, we'll write a law for you. The other kind of law is what is called common law. It's a more ancient kind of law, a tribal law. It is the law of precedence, P-R-E-C-E-D-E-N-T-S, precedence. In other words, what has been decided before is guidance and should be followed by the generations afterwards. The elders adjudicate, and that becomes the oral tradition. We decided it this way long ago. Now, that sounds kind of rock solid, but it is actually more flexible than statutory law, to the extent that over time, judges in their discretion, although they are bound by stare decisis, stare decisis, follow the law, follow the precedent, I'm sorry, see the precedent, follow it. They also have the ability to understand new circumstances and new consequences that were not understood before them. So common law is rigid. Stare decisis decides, tells the judge, informs the judge what the elders have decided before. But then beyond that, though, there is still the ability over long periods of time for the judges to understand new things and to make modifications. We don't want them to do that hardly at all, but we do recognize that they have that latitude. Now, the best example of I will give you of a common law society was the society of the ancient Germans, the Germanic tribes. And when the Germanic tribes, called the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes, came across the British, the English Channel, and began to populate England, they brought with them the tribal law, the law of the elders, common law. And so it became the foundation of English law. Unfortunately, the French invaded in 1066, in AD 1066. So the French brought their Roman law, Lex Romana, to the British Isles. And there was eventually what came about was this like hybrid thing that was what was passed to the colonies, specifically to the colonies in the America, in North America. And so we have a combination of statutory and common law. And it works like this. In a case that was adjudicated shortly after the founding of this country, a case called Marbury v. Madison, the Supreme Court of the United States arrogated to itself the right of judicial review on statutory law. In other words, the legislature will write laws that will be the supreme law, but the courts, and specifically the Supreme Court, will determine whether or not those laws constitute constitutional muster, as such cases are brought to the court for determination. So there you are, that blend. We write the laws at the legislative level, and then they are determined to be consistent with the Constitution of the United States. You will have actually several articles to read for the weekend. Plain language will expose you to more about law. It's not boring. I wrote this article for a semi-popular audience. And although it might be kind of contrary to what some people claim nowadays, it stands. And then I will also give you an article to read on agency as well. I might hold off on that one for a while. Contract falls under common law. Contract falls under common law. Contract is older than writing. I almost hurt myself there. Contract is older than writing. Contract can't be statutory law. Now, governments, legislatures, they try to declare, well, we're going to write a law about contract. But that is a fool's gambit. To the extent that a contract is a binding of parties. Whenever the government steps in, it creates, for lack of a better word, a defect in the contract, a prohibition on the contract. Sometimes we need to have that, but not always. So we go now to some types of contracts. But I do want to point out, by the way, I said ancient. How do we know they're ancient? Because we know that the peoples around the Black Sea, there was this group of people. We've given them the name the Proto-Indo-Europeans, the Indo-Europeans. These tribes that were all around the Black Seas, something, it might have been population pressure, it might have been environmental conditions, somewhere around 5,000, perhaps a little later than that, a little earlier than that, but they suddenly started expanding, so started migrating out, like tendrils in all directions. It didn't take more than a few hundred years for these peoples going their separate ways to begin to have their languages separate from each other. And that's how we can hear the ancient language in all of the languages. From those who live in India, to those who live in Spain, to those who live in the Northlands, to those who live in Eastern Europe, in the Caucasus, we can hear the whispers of the old language. We can trace back. Our languages are actually very similar if you just listen under the surface. But we have these words in all of these different languages that sound suspiciously alike. Ligature, lex, line, law, the bindings of people, contract. It was so embedded in ancient culture that the word carried out from in all the expanding tribes who engaged the diaspora. So we know contract has an old, old thing. Different kinds of contracts. I mentioned written versus oral. Now, as I had mentioned in the previous lecture, these are verbal. Verbal doesn't mean written or oral. Verbal just means it's a written or an oral. Now, the two different kinds of contracts are the written and the oral. And again, there is no defect whatsoever in an oral contract. Ipso facto. We did a contract when I ordered that food from you. That was an oral contract. You're going to do those every day, those kinds of contracts. They are oral contracts. You go to get your hair fixed. You go to get food. You go to a lot of places. You go to a movie theater. Really, in many cases, in most of your life, you will be in oral contracts, not written. Written are going to be actually somewhat unusual for you. But how often do your oral contracts fall apart? Usually they execute just fine. Now, a contract that is completed is called executed, okay? So you've heard me use that term. But now, let's get down to written contracts. If a contract is written, the entirety of the contract is within the four corners of the document. This is informally called the four corners rule. If it is not in the contract, it is not part of the contract. Well, we had these exchanges by email, or we talked about this, so, you know, that's part of the contract. Not unless it is in the four corners of the contract. We call that the four corners doctrine. More specifically, more technically, that is called the parole evidence rule. The parole evidence rule. The contract is contained in its entirety within the four corners of the contract document. Now, contracts can incorporate by reference other documents. You can amend a contract, but you be careful. If you think it is in your agreement, and your agreement is a contract, and it's a written contract, you make sure that it is in writing. Don't be, Arnold Schwarzenegger, he said, don't be a girly man. If you want it in there, you say, it is not in there, I want it in there right now. Don't let them, well, we understand that. We might, but that doesn't mean that a court will. You'll go right around me and say, Your Honor, it's not in the contract, and the court's going to say, that's right. Remember what I told you. Don't assume your opponent's intentions, only his capabilities. So you keep that in mind, the parole evidence rule. Always, if it's a written contract, you make damn sure that any understandings that you want as part of contract are in the written document. The qualification is that there is something called the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code. I'll bring it up later in the course. There are certain types of contracts where there are rules. You don't have to put it in there. It's just that the UCC governs these kinds of contracts. But other than that, just make sure that you understand the parole evidence rule. Now, an oral contract, the danger with an oral contract is the he said, she said. The he said, she said part of it. But really, in business, so much of what we do is just oral, especially in our modern world. My God, sometimes you're in businesses where you're making arrangements for shipments here and there through the day, making alternate arrangements and all that. Oral stuff going on all the time. In business, you really are as good as your word. Don't play with your word. Because oral contracts are strong. And they endure as a model for future contracts to the extent that the parties to them are trustworthy in execution. In plain English, you stand tall for one oral contract, businesses will come back to you for future oral contracts. And that's the way a lot of business is. In the world in which I worked, some aspects of the business, it was always, always written. Everything. In others, it was just words on the phone. You were trustworthy. And if someone screwed you, that person was never going to be in your scope of business activities ever again. You get a reputation real fast. And that's why when you get into these large corporations, they will, if they have a high degree of integrity, they will be good for their word. And you listen carefully. There are some corporations where, we said that, but we're going to do it this way. They do that. That's a place that you probably might want to consider. You might want to consider moving away from, because sooner or later that reputation is going to expand. And that includes supply chains, that includes the customers, that includes the employees. Because once you have violated their trust, it's like in a court of law. As long as you are telling the truth, your word is as good as a prosecutor's. But the minute there's a defect in an identifiable defect in the truthfulness of what you are saying, you've lost your hope of ever being believed by that court after that. Everything you have to say is impaired afterwards. Now, here's another way that you can divide contracts. Like I said, you can divide them in all kinds of ways. This one's kind of a little bit weird. Bilateral versus unilateral. Bilateral versus unilateral. Let me give you an example. It's better to give an example of this one. This one. I shall pay you $50 if you'll wash my car.
Okay.
Okay? Now let's try it another way. I shall pay you $50 and you shall wash my car. Those are two different contracts. You understand why?
Because you demanded in the second one. And
no, I didn't demand.
Well, you said if you give me $50, then I have to wash your car.
That was the first one I did that in.
Then what was the second one?
Okay, in the first one I said, I shall pay you $50 if you will wash my car. Okay. And the second one, I shall pay you $50 and you shall wash my car. In the second one, I think I know you're on the right track. In the second one, there are two contracts. I am going to pay you $50. That's not contingent upon you wash. You have to wash my car. I have to pay you $50. Mm-hmm. There are two obligations there. That's bilateral. In the first one, I don't have to pay you $50 unless you wash my car. So that in the first one, it's a contingency. There's only one agreement going on there. In the second one, he is on the hook. Whether or not I pay him the $50, you're on the hook because you agree. You accept it. I shall pay you $50 and you shall wash my car. That means you shall wash my car. And you better do a good job. The detailing, I don't want to see any smudges, none of that dog pee on my tires after this is done, really. Oh, sorry. And leave the change alone under the seat. I use that for noms. Bilateral versus unilateral. Okay. Now, I have gone around the barn five times. Now, let me get back to the outhouse here. The first of the four pillars is offer and acceptance. The second of the pillars is mutual consideration. Thing of value for thing of value. Thing of value for thing of value. And the mutual consideration must be timely. There's one place where that's not necessarily true. It's called promissory estoppel, where you don't have to pay right away. But in general, thing of value now for thing of value now. Okay, so it has to happen in a timely fashion, this mutual consideration. So let's try this one. I'm your uncle. I've given you a very nice gift. A Ferrari. Sweet. Now I expect you to do some work for me. You took my car, you accepted it. But there's no contract. You see that? There's no contract. There was no mutual consideration. A gift is not... Accepting a gift does not establish a contract. Accepting the gift. I can give you a gift. It means nothing as far as contract goes. So I can take you, and I don't mean to, forgive me for this. I can take you to Denny's, and then we can go bowling. And then after that, we'll drive around the town here and look at the lights and say, ooh and ah, and try to run over the jaywalking students, which really pissed me off because, you know what? Oh, anyway. And at the end of the evening, you step out of the car and I say, wait a minute, you must give me a hug. What the hell is that? And you owe me. I bought you dinner at Denny's. Really? I mean, come on. I mean, that was a grand slam you got, you cow. And all this. And bowling. I paid for the shoes for you, for heaven's sake. You owe me. No, you don't. Absolutely not. There was no mutual agreement. There was no agreement, thing of value for thing of value. That's the end. That's it. That's why if I get in, you, a gentleman, if you get engaged, you give that lady an engagement ring, she can keep it and say, kiss my ass. You know, I'm marrying this studly guy in the frat over there. He's wealthy. You aren't. You suck. Okay? So don't give that ring. I mean, unless you've got some kind of a magnetic thing on so you can pull it off her finger if she, or I don't know. But you see, you must understand there's no contract unless it's thing of value for thing of value. Well, she promised to marry me. Is that really a thing of value? Let me tell you, no, it's not. Oh, mutual consideration. And you must understand that it has to be a real valuable thing. It must have liquidatable damages. It can't be just some diffuse thing, some open promise. It must be clear and specific and timely. The example that I would give you comes, I think this was a case in Arizona. A young man and a young woman in their college years got to know each other. They became romantically involved. And they decided that they would marry. And they worked it out like this. One of them would work and pay for the other one to go to graduate school. And then when that partner was finished, then the other one would go to graduate school. They would have a lot of money. So the way they worked it out is that the man would go to law school and the woman would work and stay at home and have a child. And then when he had finished law school, he'd get a really good law job, a lawyer job, and then he'd pay for her to go to whatever school she decided that she wanted to go to. She'd have time to think about what she wanted to do. Well, he got his law degree. He indeed scored very well in his class. He got a job with a very reputable law firm. And there he met a very, very attractive female lawyer. And he married her. And he got involved with her. And then he told his wife, I want a divorce. Well, of course, she went bananas. You promised you were going to put me through grad school. I put you through grad school. You promised. She sued under contract. The judge ruled no contract. Why not? Why not? This was, by the way, the case where the judge, this case actually, one law professor, wonderful comment, he said, this is known as the men are assholes case. And the judge just felt, obviously did not like how it was coming out. And this was the one where he hinted that she might want to revisit under quasi-contract. But he said, this isn't a contract. Why wasn't it a contract? Come on. Well, she was giving everything. She worked her ass off. She worked a job where he started their family and put him through law school only to have him. That was part of it. That's part of it. What's the other?
Because she wasn't specific.
Bull, God, yes, give her a cookie. Both of you are right. Because there wasn't any immediacy of the mutual consideration. She was doing all the consideration. There was no immediacy. And then she had not been specific about what her side of the consideration would be. Well, I kind of want to go to art school, but I don't know what grad school. So we couldn't even put liquidated damages on it because she hadn't decided on what college. It could have been a cheapo special school or a very expensive school. So we couldn't put a damage value on what had happened. And in the other point is exactly right, too. Where was he in all this? Well, obviously, you know, you're a guy, so you're going to say, hey, I was the lover. But, you know, that's not good enough. I've tried to say that. I'm sorry you had to do the dishes, but hey, I did all the work last night. It doesn't work. I mean, you get slapped. If you're lucky, that'll be the end of it. Sometimes you get your tires slashed. You see, It has to be clear and specific. Why does it have to be clear and specific? Because there has to be a liquidatable damage measure. If you can't say what was the value, then that's it. The third is capacity. The third of the four pillars is capacity. You must be capable of entering into contract. Know this. A contract with a minor is voidable at the discretion of the minor. A contract with a minor is voidable at the discretion of the minor. In other words, it's not void, but it's voidable. So if you get involved with a contract with a minor, as I tell my in business law classes, you're stupid as hell. The only exception to the voidability rule is that if it is for something that is a necessity, then the minor can't void it. So we have the case of the father and son. The son was a minor, had a big falling out with the father, left the residence, and entered into a lease for an apartment. Later, the father and the son reconciled, and the son moved back in and said, I void the contract for the lease. As a minor, the contract was voidable at my discretion. The landlord said, under normal circumstances, yes, you could void, but this is for shelter, and therefore it is not voidable at your discretion. It was for a necessity. So you are on the hook for the 1 year of rent. You cannot void the contract because it was for a necessity. The argument by the father and son was it wasn't a necessity. He could always have moved back in. He didn't have to live there. He could have lived at home. I'll let you try to figure out who would win that one. It's an interesting one. Capacity. It gets complicated. Back a long time ago, we would have considered people with, for example, Down syndrome to be incapable of entering into contract. They're mentally impaired. Therefore, a Down syndrome victim may not marry. Fortunately, our understanding of Down syndrome is far more enlightened now, and those defects in capacity are no longer considered to be showstoppers. We have example, I believe it was several years ago, the first person with Down syndrome got a PhD. It turns out that Down syndrome is not brain dead. You're still okay. You just have some very difficult wiring problems that make it learning the way we model learning hard. But in and of itself, no. Now, I'm going to give you another point here. And you're going to see it back and forth. Some textbooks are going to say, you know, it's one way. I take my cue from one of the great law professors from whom I learned this case. So apparently out of Georgia, from what I understand. There were two couples. They lived next to each other. They were neighbors. They would get together every Friday night and get themselves a drink, get themselves a big fun time, the two couples would. And they one Friday they'd be at the one couple's house, the next Friday they'd be at the other couple's house. Well, the one Friday they were at the one couple's house, and they were getting drunk. I mean, they were, technically speaking, they were shit-faced. And the guy who owned the house, he said, this house is such a piece of crap, I'd sell this to you for a dollar. The guy says, okay, you put that in a right. So he writes on a napkin, I hereby sell this house to my friend, gave his name, for $1. The next day, the fellow came over and said, here's your dollar, I want your house. No. It was, no, wait. Couldn't be. It went to court. You know what? Guess who won? Yeah, there's a guy who got a dollar for his house out there, very pissed off. Don't assume that being drunk makes you incapable of entering into contract. Do not assume it. You can be stoned. You can be drunk. In technical terms, you can be wasted. And you could still be held. Now, there are some textbooks that say, oh, no, you can't. Oh, don't assume that. Well, it wasn't serious. It was a joke. It was serious enough that he wrote it on a damn napkin. There's a problem with a written contract right there. Uh-oh, my ass is on the line in writing here. It can't be a he said, she said. So there you are. Be careful about capacity. You can be drunk on your ass. Now, that doesn't mean that this falls into sexual matters. Sexual matters are not contract. Don't say, well, she was drunk, she said yes, so it's not rape. That doesn't qualify because rape, sex is not contract. God knows I thought it was a few times, but that was just because I was in the army. And there's a fourth one, legality. Yes, I will edit this podcast, damn it. No, actually, I do take out a few things, like the time I farted violently in class. No, I'm serious. I walked out the hall, and before I could get out there, I mean, the trumpets of Gabriel sounded. People thought the apocalypse was here. The rapture was at hand. They thought more after I said Jesus. Where the hell was I? Legality. You cannot contract for what is illegal. You're lonely. You're new in town. You just got off the ship. And there I am standing there in the mist. Hello, sailor. And you know what that means. Yes, I have watches to sell. Rolex. Now, follow with me. It sounds like a contract. Offer. Hello, sailor. Acceptance. Yo. Mutual consideration. $50 for a Rolex. Capacity. We're both adults. We're both sane. But it's not legal. And obviously, I'm talking about prostitution. Prostitution is not legal. Drug dealing is not legal. You cannot take a drug dealer to court because he said it was high-quality marijuana. It turned out that it was ground-up parsley, which you found to be actually fairly pleasant anyway. But you see, you cannot contract for that which is illegal. So that there is a something that's kind of interesting that you make sure that what you are engaging in is a contract by virtue of the legality of it. And I, interestingly enough, honestly, when I did consulting work, one of the ways that I made money was brokering, being in brokerage chains. Well, we hear there's something here and there's someone over here that needs or wants to buy this. A lot of it was bullshit. You get these weird things like there's this giant ruby that's hiding in a mine and we can set up a deal so that the Saudi prince can buy it. Weird stuff. But there was legit stuff too. One thing that I did run into was that in some cases, I thought I was engaging in a perfectly legal activity, so it would be a contract. Turned out that what I was, it was unlawful in the jurisdiction in which I was trying to do the contract. Especially that had to do with there were medical supplies in a warehouse, and I wanted to transact those in a brokerage chain. It was a short brokerage chain, good money to be made, and all that. Turned out that it was unlawful to sell these medical supplies because they had been sitting around for so long, you know. I don't know the details, but my lawyer said if I didn't back off, I could end up being some hard-timer's old lady. Now, let me tie this up with a couple of points. Contracts can have problems during their execution. You want to make sure that contingencies are covered to the best of your ability within the four corners of the contract, or if it's an oral contract, that, okay, well, what happens if this breaks down or that breaks down? Now, let me give you an idea, an example. You have a process. You make bread and you buy the grain for the bread from an authentic grain mill in, let's say, in New England. And the grain mill, you have a contract for a certain amount every week of this grain to make your bread. Now, suddenly the grain mill says, we can't fulfill contract. The mill wheel, this axle, broke. We have the only company that makes this axle anymore says it's going to be 2 weeks before they can build a new one to the exact specifications of this one. So we're not going to be able to provide for 2 weeks. You immediately sue for breach of contract. Is that lawsuit going to go anywhere? No. Not unless you can show that you made a duly diligent effort to find another source for the grain for the 2 weeks. You cannot just sue without attempting mitigation. In other words, you have a duty to mitigate under contract. You can't just scream breach until you have demonstrated that you used reasonable effort to mitigate any loss that would occur under contract. This is the same principle that applies to us in our normal lives. You see a car up ahead and it's on the wrong side of the road, you are not allowed to just drive up and hit that car. You have a duty to mitigate. You can't just say, well, I saw that pedestrian and he didn't run. I just, bam, taught him a lesson. I do that too, but then I back over him again a couple of times to make sure that he can't tell his side of the story. Goes back to, any of you see the movie Zombieland? There was one of the rules about how you deal with zombies. Don't forget the double tap. You shoot a zombie not once, twice. You'll be glad you did. If you hit a pedestrian, drive back over him. I'm actually going to get one of those truck horns for my car. I'm going to let them just go by me, just sauntering, swaggering like this. And as soon as they get by me, I'm going to move their bowels. Where the hell was it? Okay. You have a duty to mitigate in your personal lives. You have a duty not just to mitigate, but to take action proportionately. Proportionality is part of it too. Look, 2 weeks. You're going to sue them for $1 billion? Really? No. You're probably not even going to get anywhere unless you can show that you tried to get around the supply bottleneck. So there you are. That, in a nutshell, is enough about contracts to possibly make you aware of the details and maybe even make you dangerous. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.